I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad.
What if what we call public opinion was just a manufactured narrative that makes it easier to convince people that if their views are different, then there's something wrong with that, or there's something wrong with them?
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Please shut down the system.
And now for Newsreel, these are your hosts, Maltos and Gatekeeper.
It is a good day. This is Mike reporting to you from the internet for Sunday, November 16th, 2014. You are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening in and distributing this program, you are too. You can follow along with our news stories and check our facts by going to newsreel.ca. This is a free WOGcast and can be heard on Rant Radio Talk each and every Sunday afternoon at 1400 hours Pacific Time or 2 p.m. Pacific Time. Anybody else out there that's Eastern Time, there's a few of you, that would be, I guess, 5 o'clock Pacific Time or 1700 hours. There's a 3-hour difference. Anyways, I still need to change the intro for the show, apparently, because I haven't done it this week. So, I'm working on it. Give me a break. Anyways, my week is pretty boring. So, like, once again, I'm not going to bore anybody with details. So we'll head straight into the news. Yes, we will head straight into the news. I was going to say something else there, but it just left me. Completely derailed that train of thought. Anyways, in cryptocurrency news, thank you to Kevin as a Geek for this one. Man has NFC chips injected into his hands to store cold Bitcoin wallet. Entrepreneur, it's not cold because it's 37 degrees inside my body. Anyways, NFC is near field communication chips for anybody that doesn't know what that is, which is essentially a form of RFID, I believe. So, yeah, so insert picture of the guy's hands with the x-rays there showing the chips embedded right between in the fleshy part between his thumb and his index fingers. It's kind of interesting, but let's get into the news here then. Any serious Bitcoin user will preach the benefits of cold storage, which is keeping the bulk of your Bitcoins offline somewhere, like on an encrypted USB stick or even printed on a piece of paper. The idea is that by keeping that data offline, it's far less susceptible to being hacked. Yes, because if anything's online, there's going to be a way to get to it one way or another, unless, you know, you're the NSA. And even then, there's other countries hacking them, so whatever. So the theory goes, what could be safer than keeping it inside of your own body? For the last 10 days, Martin Wismijer, whatever your name is, sorry guy, a Dutch entrepreneur and Bitcoin enthusiast has lived with an NFC chip embedded in each hand. One has data that he's constantly overwriting. He can put his contact details in simply by having another person scan his hand with an NFC-enabled phone, which a lot of them are these days. But the other contains the encrypted private key to his wallet. Quote, I use it for cold storage, but it's not cold because it's 37 degrees inside my body. Ha ha, funny guy, unquote. He told Ars, this is Ars Technica article, over Skype on Friday. Specifically, he has an NFC Type 2 compliant NTA G216 RFID chipset. Yeah, that's long enough. Embedded in a tiny glass capsule, 2 millimeters by 12 millimeters, that was injected into the fleshy part of his hand between his thumb and index finger, like I said earlier. Each capsule can hold just 880 bytes of data, which is more than enough for a cold storage wallet, because it's just code, essentially, I believe. The Dutchman got it as part of a preloaded syringe sold as a $99 kit from DangerousThings.com. Yeah, that's an awesome website name. A Washington state-based website that sells to hobbyists and biohackers. On November 3rd, 2014, Wismijer had it installed by Tom Van Oudenaarde. I completely butchered up that, or butchered that name there.
Butchered up.
of piercing Studio Utrecht after his own Amsterdam doctor refused. "My doctor doesn't like it," Wismijer said. "He didn't want to do it, he just wants to make people better, and I'm not sick. I just want this thing inside my body." He was right. So that's why you need body manipulation artists. Yay! There's a video there, which I haven't seen yet. But it's probably, well, obviously, subdermal NFC chip implants, what the name of it is. It hurts more than a normal injection. I would think so, because it's not liquid going in your body, it's something solid. So how does Wismijer actually use his hand-based system in practice? He gave me an example. As the CEO of Mr. Bitcoin, an Amsterdam-based firm that sets up Bitcoin ATMs in the Netherlands and Belgium, he frequently needs to stock Bitcoins on those machines. We minimize our risk by... I'm getting really fast with the words here. We minimize our risk by storing most of them in cold storage, and only when we see a lot of... Okay. And only when we see a lot of happening do we transfer to a hot wallet, he said. Using Shamir's shared secret, click on the link there, a cryptographic technique to split a secret amongst different people, Wismijer and his colleagues have to provide a certain number of their private keys to unlock the company's master cold storage wallet. They can either scan the NFC tags with a USB dongle or from an NFC-enabled phone. To transfer funds to our network, we have to scan our tags, including my hand, which provides part of an encrypted private key, and then only the phone will transfer to the hot wallet, he said. If you had a will, and everyone would have a will, you could create a shared secret, and you could use that to execute the will. You can't find such a solution. There's no notary involved. It will revolutionize asset management. Of course, this isn't the first time that people have installed NFC or their predecessors' RFID tags inside their own bodies. Back in 2004, a nightclub in Barcelona opted to implant RFID tags into the shoulders. Yeah, I really want that injected in me. Of a select group of customers so they could use it as a digital wallet rather than carry cash or credit cards. Clearly, it hasn't been met with widespread adoption. Yeah, I don't think so either because, like, seriously. Oh, I'll put this in you so you don't have to worry about carrying cash. I think I'll just... You know, keep your credit card on you or your debit card or your $20 bill or $40 worth of money or something like that. Just keep it on you. It's not that thick. You don't even need to carry a wallet. Stick it in your underwear. There you go. Boom. You know, if you're worried about having it lost or something. So, yeah, a bit of a tangent there, but whatever. Unlocking a door. Eventually, Wismijer would... like to replace his home door locks with NFC tags so that he can open his front door with just his hand. That's what Emma Grafstra, the founder of DangerousThings.com, had been doing for nearly a decade. He too has the NFC chips installed in the webbing of his hands and has $200 Samsung Eisen door locks on his house. Click on the link there. I remember hearing about that story a few years back. So that might have actually been on the original newsreel. Anyway, since 2005, That's what I've primarily been using it for, and I've been really happy, he told ours. It unlocks when I reach for the doorknob, and I go in a little high, and it opens. Okay. He doesn't even notice that the chip's there anymore. You don't even think about it. That's the whole point of implantable technology. Grasser said the company has sold around 10,000 different types of implants since founding the company, and is currently working with Wismijer to further adapt the Bitcoin use case. And was getting the NFC chips injected painful for Wismijer? Quote, it hurts more than a normal injection. It's like a drip line in a hospital. It looks painful, but it's not that painful, he said, adding that it doesn't feel any different when he scans his hand. Yeah, it's not going to feel any different because it doesn't. I mean, it's a passive thing. It doesn't heat up, he said, but that doesn't mean it's fully unnoticeable just yet. Grasstra noted that usually it takes people a couple of months to fully ignore it and incorporate it into their daily routine. You notice it because it's not yet encapsulated. The hole is gone, and that's healed, so there's no chance that it will infect, as Mitra said. Of course, it's covered in glass, so it's, not going to be. Shouldn't be rejected anyways. That's very, very cool. And I guess the guy with the doors and stuff, I've heard about that before, and that's really cool. And this is actually pretty cool because it's not just... from what I see here, it's not just his, or you need to have multiple things scanned in order to get the data off of the one chip or RFID or whatever you want to call it. So that is, like, I guess, distributed security or whatnot, right? That's pretty cool. Instead of, so you don't have to worry about, oh, well, they're going to hack it. Well, they're only going to get a chunk of the encryption, right? I guess is what I'm getting out of this. Maybe I'm wrong. Hey, if somebody wants to hit me up with more information on that, then awesome. Newsreel2.com or, newsreel.ca or email at newsreel2@gmail.com. On to the next story. Thanks to Kevin as a Geek again for this one. President Obama calls for a free and open internet, wants it reclassified as a utility. This is a TechCrunch article from November 10th. Insert video of Obama talking about keeping the internet open. President Barack Obama has come out in favor of net neutrality in a special website and video announcement wherein he lays out his plan for protecting the freedom and openness of the internet. In a video and letter, he lays out in no uncertain terms that he believes no cable company or access provider should be able to put limits on access to the internet. Good on ya. Because they shouldn't. They really shouldn't be. They're providing a service. It should just be no restrictions. Seriously, do not throttle people and all that other crap. He says that he's suggesting that the FCC recognizes access to the internet as a basic utility and something that Americans have a basic right to. Yes, just like heat, water, electricity, you kind of need to have an information stream. This means no blocking, no throttling, more transparency, and no paid prioritization. So no internet fast lane, slow lane crap. Obama writes in his letter, which is quoted in full below. This might take me a while to read. An open internet is essential to the American economy and increasingly to our very way of life. By lowering the cost of launching a new idea, igniting new political movements, and bringing communities closer together, it has been one of the most significant democratizing influences the world has ever known. Net neutrality has been built into the fabric of the internet since its creation, but it is also a principle that we cannot take for granted. We cannot allow internet service providers, or ISPs, to restrict the best access or to pick winners and losers in the online marketplace for services and ideas. That is why today I am asking the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, to answer the call of almost 4 million public comments and implement the strongest possible rules to protect net neutrality. Now I need to cut in here. 4 million public comments against this and blah, blah, blah. How many people are in the United States? A few hundred million, I think, isn't there? So that's quite a small number. But at the very least, they're going with the minority on this here, which is good. Which is extremely good. When I was a candidate for this office, I made clear my commitment to a free and open internet, and my commitment remains as strong as ever. 4 years ago, the FCC tried to implement rules that would protect net neutrality with little to no impact on the telecom companies that make important investments in our economy. After the rules were challenged, the court reviewing the rules agreed with the FCC that net neutrality was essential for preserving an environment that encourages new investment in the network, new online services, and content, and everything else that makes up the internet as we now know it. Unfortunately, the court ultimately struck down the rules, not because it disagreed with the need to protect net neutrality, but because it believed the FCC had taken the wrong legal approach. The FCC is an independent agency, and ultimately, this decision is theirs alone. I believe the FCC should create a new set of rules protecting net neutrality and ensuring that neither the cable company nor the phone company will be able to act as a gatekeeper, restricting what you can do or see online. The rules I am asking for are simple. Common sense steps that reflect the internet you and I use every day and that some ISPs already observe. These bright line rules include no blocking. If a consumer requests access to a website or service and the content is legal, your ISP should not be permitted to block it. That way, every player, not just those commercially affiliated with an ISP, get a fair shot at your business. Perfect. No throttling. Nor should ISPs be able to intentionally slow down some content or speed up others through a process often called throttling, based on this type of service or your ISP's preferences. And we all know what throttling is. depending on the ISP. Just for instance, you can, if you're downloading through torrent or off torrent sites or whatever with torrent programs, you know, say they have noticed something, your internet usage is up during certain times, they will throttle it at certain times, and blah blah blah. And just that's a horrible one. But anyways, so that's that. Increased transparency. The connection between consumers and ISPs, the so-called last mile, is not the only place some sites might get special treatment. So I am also asking the FCC to make full use of the transparency authorities the court recently upheld, and if necessary, to apply net neutrality rules to points of interconnection between the ISP and the rest of the internet. No paid prioritization. A lot of background noise here, sorry. No paid prioritization. Simply put, no service should be stuck in a slow lane because it doesn't pay a fee. That kind of gatekeeping would undermine the level playing field essential to the internet's growth. So as I have before, I am asking for an explicit ban on paid prioritization and other restriction that has a similar effect. If carefully designed, these rules should not create any undue burden for ISPs and can have clear, monitored exceptions for reasonable network management and for specialized services such as dedicated mission-critical networks serving a hospital. But combined, these rules mean everything for preserving the internet's openness. Now, I was going to say something in there, but I can't remember where it went. Oh yeah, where he's talking about it being carefully designed. They shouldn't create any undue burden for ISPs. Well, you think that with the crap that they're doing, that blocking, the throttling, not keeping things as transparent as they should, and all the paid prioritization, if they get rid of all that crap, or the blocking and throttling at least, well, they don't have to devote the resources to that crap. Just leave the internet open, you know? So it essentially relieves burdens, I would assume. The rules have to reflect the way people use the internet today, and honestly, they should reflect how the internet is going to be used in the future too, but whatever. Which increasingly means on a mobile device. I believe that the FCC should make these rules fully applicable to mobile broadband as well, while recognizing the special challenges that come with managing wireless networks. To be current, these rules must also build on the lessons of the past. For almost a century, our law has recognized that companies who connect you to the world have special obligations not to exploit the monopoly they enjoy over access in and out of your home or business. That is why a phone call from a customer of one phone company can reliably reach a customer of a different one, and why you will not be penalized solely for calling somebody who is using another provider. It is common sense that the same philosophy should guide any service that is based on the transmission of information, whether a phone call or a packet of data. So the time has come for the FCC to recognize that broadband service is of the same importance and must carry the same obligations as so many of the other vital services do. To do that, I believe that the FCC should reclassify consumer broadband service under Title II of the Telecommunications Act, while at the same time forbearing from rate regulation and other provisions less relevant to broadband services. This is a basic acknowledgement of the service. This is a basic acknowledgement of the services ISPs provide to American homes and businesses and not straightforward obligations necessary to ensure the network works for everyone, not just one or two companies. Investment in wired and wireless networks. I have to take a drink here. Sorry, guys. Oh, that's better. Man, my throat's all friggin' dry and scratchy. I'm choking. Okay, I think I stopped and ended up right there. Let's wrap it, broadband. This is a basic acknowledgement of the services ISPs provide to American homes and businesses and the straightforward obligations necessary to ensure the network works for everyone, not just one or two companies. Investment in wired and wireless networks has supported jobs and made America the center of a vibrant ecosystem of digital devices, apps, and platforms that fuel growth and expand opportunity. Importantly, network investment remained strong under the previous net neutrality regime, before it was struck down by the court. In fact, the court agreed that protecting net neutrality helps foster more investment and innovation. Yeah, because there's no blocking and throttling and crap. You can get stuff done quicker. Importantly, network investment remained... I already said that. the innovation if the FCC appropriately forbears from the Title II regulations that are not needed to implement the principles above, principles that most ISPs have followed for years. It will help ensure new rules are consistent with incentives for further investment in the infrastructure of the internet. The internet has been one of the greatest gifts of our economy, one of the greatest gifts our economy and our society has ever known. The FCC was chartered to promote competition, innovation, and investment in our networks. In service of that mission, there is no higher calling than protecting an open, accessible, and free internet. I thank the commissioners for having served this cause with distinction and integrity, and I respectfully ask them to adopt the policies I have outlined here to preserve this text promise for today and future generations to come. Ooh, that's the end of that letter. That's pretty big. Obama acknowledges that the FCC has the ultimate final say in how it addresses the issue of net neutrality, and admits that all he can do is make a recommendation. Which, if you are the President of the United States, why don't you just tell him to just do it? Anyways, specifically that the internet, that internet access and specifically broadband connectivity be treated as a Title II service under the Telecommunications Act of 1996. This provision defines heavier regulatory requirements than broadband currently enjoys at a Title I provision, and would likely hamstring any attempts to create so-called internet fastens, where carriers can charge websites to increase their own speed of delivery to customers and slow down others. Which, I guess that wouldn't be so bad if they're just talking about only YouTube, because YouTube sucks ass for their speed. But, you know, in general, no, it's a bad thing. Support from the president for Title II reclassification of broadband access is huge and not something the FCC lobby groups or anyone else can ignore lightly. The state of net neutrality, when last appraised, appeared murky. Click on the link there. But recent reports of a delay on any vote from the FCC on new rules being pushed back into 2015 now appear more likely to come true as the regulatory body takes into account this powerful new development. So that is... Well, that's very interesting. Pretty cool that Obama's siding with that. So that's, well, I guess you could say, well, he is a heavy hitter, really, when it comes to influencing things, obviously. But again, like I said in the article, it's ultimately up to the FCC. Although, you know, maybe the FCC should be abolished and all that crap, and maybe replaced with somebody that does their job better. But whatever. Also, another thing, flip side to this coin with this story here is, oh, President Obama's wanting this, blah, 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 blah. He's government itself, obviously. Well, let's say that with the whole NSA crap going on and the new data center and stuff, well, if you throttle stuff and whatever, blah, 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 maybe let's open up the internet to everybody properly like it was before or like it should be, and then they can do whatever they want, and then we get more information quicker. You know, I don't know. Or copyright infringement crap, you know what I mean? Oh, we're not gonna throttle you, but we'll be able to pick up on you more because you're downloading more stuff that's not being throttled, and I don't know. Again, me and my tangents. Crazy Maltos. Anyways, into the next story. In improper equipment for the job news. Thank you to Woggle War for this one. There we go. My page was not... switching. 13 states refused to disclose how many tanks, assault weapons, etc. they've gotten from the 1033 program. The 1033 program is the one that obviously is in the United States, where any old military equipment from Iraq or wherever, really, is being, hey, you want this, you want that, you know, the school boards get the MRAP and all that stuff, you know, that's what that program is. There's 1033 program, I think the 1027 program is another similar program. But since the Pentagon refuses to disclose which police departments nationwide had received weapons, armored vehicles, and even bomb robots, Muck Rock, okay, I don't know what the hell, or who the hell Muck Rock is, but okay. Muck Rock submitted public records requests to all 50 state coordinators. More than half the states, click on the link there, released their spreadsheets. To date, 37 states have done so, opening up the 1033 program to public accountability. Good. 13 state coordinators that have yet to disclose which agencies have received access to military equipment. Okay. The reasons that state coordinators cited for withholding agency-by-agency data varied. The Michigan Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, for instance, cited an exemption under the state public records statute for investigating records, investigating records compiled for law enforcement purposes, unquote, but failed to explain how the 1033 program spreadsheets fall into this category. The Massachusetts State Police similarly claimed, click on the link there, that releasing the 1033 equipment transfer spreadsheet would, quote, undermine public safety as it relates to security measures and emergency preparedness, unquote. Now, I need to say something about this because I do have training in emergency management. I went to, part of my schooling was for that. Emergency management deals with emergency preparedness, prevention, mitigation, recovery, response, all that other fun crap. Everything dealing with emergencies. Now, this here, for security measures, it doesn't really undermine public safety because of the fact that, well, if you're cops, you're going to have guns. If you're security forces, you're going to have guns. You're going to have equipment. So it's not really a bad thing. You know, if you're going to kill a terrorist with a sniper rifle, oh, we don't want to know a sniper. It doesn't matter. You can kill them with a friggin' Remington 700 bought from a store, or you can buy and shoot them with a Barrett M50 or a 50 cal or whatever the hell the big Barrett 50 cal sniper rifle is. You can shoot them with that. You know, it doesn't really matter what they're being shot with. They're being shot. You can't really defend against something like that, sort of being inside of a building. And as far as the emergency preparedness thing, seriously, that's supposed to be public knowledge anyways, emergency preparedness, what the government's doing for that crap, so the equipment you have is supposed to be public knowledge, or it should be anyways. It's like a whole bunch of ethical stuff that could be tied into that too, I would assume, but whatever. Massachusetts State Police training at Fort Devens. There is a YouTube video, 4 minutes 37 seconds, you can click on there. The North Carolina Department of Public Safety suggested that releasing this spreadsheet would, quote, be like providing criminals a blueprint on how to harm law enforcement or get around the security tactics when trying to prevent crime and or a serious event, unquote. And yes, that would be true. I guess if you're dealing with armored vehicles and stuff, sure. But as far as the weapons that you're carrying as a police officer or anybody really on the ground, oh, well, we have this, and we have that. Like, seriously, do people know what you have? And it's not that difficult to figure out what the military has, so it's like, well, okay, these guys possibly have that, so let's prepare for the worst-case scenario. They're going to have military equipment. Six states rejected the request outright. That would include Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, North Carolina, South Dakota, and West Virginia, ones we talked about already here. Muckrock, whoever the hell that is, I'm assuming this is the person that runs this massive private hell website. I'm not sure. Or somebody that follows it anyways. Muckrock has appealed these rejections for Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, and South Dakota. There is no administrative appeal available to requesters under the public records statutes in North Carolina and West Virginia. Six states claim not to have any such spreadsheet, including Alabama, Delaware, Maine, Rhode Island, Virginia, and Wyoming. Which seems a bit doubtful, because if you're going to be getting equipment from somewhere, you're probably going to have a record of it. That seems like the logical and also legal thing to do. And your due diligence thing kind of comes through that too, right? The Louisiana Federal Property Assistance Agency of Louisiana, of all places, Louisiana Agency of Louisiana, insisted that fulfilling the same request would involve printing approximately 20,000 pages of paper files at a cost of $5,000. Okay, $5,000. Seriously? You can just make a PDF and email it. Works quicker. To inspect the records at our office, contact us to schedule a date and time. You may obtain copies after your inspection. If you would like to pick up copies from our office, contact us to schedule a time. We will send you an invoice for copying costs, but the estimated copying cost for all records is $5,000. Free. This is an excerpt from, I'm assuming, the letter or email. We will send you an invoice for copying, blah, blah, blah. Please bring your... your payment when you come to pick up the records. If you prefer to receive copies via the post office, we will obtain the shipping costs and include it in the invoice with copying costs. The records will be shipped once the payment is received. Shipping would cost extra, the agency indicated. Yeah. Notably, the LFPAA, Louisiana Federal Property Assistance Agency of Louisiana, has not provided a copy of the memorandum of agreement each state coordinator must sign with the Defense Logistics Agency. Even states that rejected the request for agency-by-agency spreadsheets provided this basic agreement. Let's click on the link there for that. Veteran cop. Is that the same thing? Yeah, okay, it's a header. I thought it was a link. It's a blue. Veteran cop defends law enforcement's use of military vehicles using condescension and baseless claims. 15-year police veteran Steve Rabinovich posted an article, which is actually more of an advertisement for two tactical training companies, discussing the proper care and feeding of your police department's MRAP. And there's a link on that there. Now through the 1033 program, this is a quote, I guess, from this. Now through the 1033 program, these officers and deputies are prepared to use the proper tools for what threats may come. We all understand that improper and ignorant application of these tools is not only a liability, it's deliberate indifference. These trucks feel, drive, and act like unlike anything most drivers and teams are used to. To simply put them to use without proper training is asking for people to get hurt or killed. Yes, because it is a military vehicle. It's designed essentially for off-roading all the time and driving over bombs and surviving shit like that. They're also large, armored, and heavy. Rabinovich details the MRAP training, most of which involves handling the heavy, unwieldy vehicles, as well as a unique bonding experience that is advanced tactical training at a flagship Nebraska facility, unquote. One of the most unique things about this course was a positive attitude and genuine desire to learn, which didn't stop when the class was dismissed. Everything from class topics to shooting positions to medical equipment was discussed around the fire pit under the Nebraska moon. Sounds kind of kinky. Rabinovich linked to another article, quote, your agency got a 1033 MRAP, unquote, which might be viewed as tone deaf at best. In this one, Rabinovich offers three justifications for any law enforcement agency that feels a mine-resistant vehicle is a worthy addition to its fleet of vehicles. One, better equipped and trained police are a better asset to protect and serve the communities. Well, that has nothing to do with the fact that you're driving a multi-ton armored mine-resistant vehicle. Better equip and train your people, yes, but you do not need to have a huge vehicle like that. Two, in some quarters, violent anti-government groups and individuals are targeting cops as scapegoats. Okay, yeah, but what you're going to do is just all get to the scene and start shooting at you. You're just going to chill out in your MRAP there and cook some beans on the stove in the back and just wait it out. Seriously, you're cops. You're supposed to get out there and do your job. If you want to have something armored, why don't you armor your cars? Maybe, put some bulletproof glass in them. I don't know if they already do or not. But do that, put run flats in the tires. And armor the door panels and the roofs and stuff like that. Armor the bottom of it. It'll make the cars heavier, but holy crap, just up the engine capacity. Boom, you're rocking. You know what I mean? Put Kevlar tires on. I don't know. Put the money somewhere else. I mean, technically, these guys are getting stuff for free, but you know what I mean? Seriously, invest somewhere proper. There has been a steady increase in deadly and violent assaults on cops. It's probably because you're driving around military equipment. As well as acts of domestic and international terrorism, many of which are recorded in limited scope or not publicly known. Now, the domestic and international terrorism crap, which, yes, it is happening, but, what are you going to do? Oh, we're driving this, blah, blah, blah. If you're going to deal with something where you need to drive a military vehicle, that's what you call a military in for. That's what the National Guard or the Reserve Forces are for, or the regular force, even, right? You bring them in. It takes a little bit longer, yes, for them to come in, depending on where you are in location to one of their bases. But, you know what I mean? If you're not... Police officers, I don't think, are exactly trained to handle the same type of situations that a soldier is. Maybe I'm wrong. There could be... LEOs out there, law enforcement officers, and current and past, present, whatever, military people out there that are listening to the show, I'm not sure. But I would assume that the training is considerably different, not being either of those myself. But I would assume that there's a different level of training for military, and counterterrorism operatives and all this other fun stuff. Anyways, the argument rests on the assumption that a more well-protected police force is a net win for the community. Which, yes and no. So, how does the acquisition of an MRAP better train police? But Benefits doesn't explore this logical dead end any further, so it's left up to the audience to make its own assumptions. Violent anti-government groups is a very recent talking point. One used to paint government accountability groups as violent, using a very broad brush in hopes of destroying the credibility of peaceful streets or cop block. Never heard of either of those, but okay. Rabinovich further cheapens this by portraying these groups as scapegoating police officers, but once again fails to clarify his choice of words. Nothing further is written that explains why these officers are being scapegoated, and Rabinovich doesn't even bother to give any examples of this targeting. Yeah, you're gonna scapegoat somebody. Like, the definition of scapegoat is, ah, oh, this happened, ah, oh, we'll blame this person, and send them off, and kill them. It's kind of like, I guess it kind of is like false flag thing, really. Possibly what happened with Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden. Oh, he's a scapegoat, you know what I mean? A lot of crap happened and stuff, but was he the actual one? Everything's all fine now, but again, was he the actual one? Yay for my tangents. Police work isn't becoming increasingly dangerous, even with the supposed corresponding uptick in domestic and international terrorism. Well, probably because domestic and international terrorists aren't targeting cops, they're usually targeting the military. Or, well, civilians. Yeah. Send me some hate mail for that. Rabinovich must know this assertion won't hold up because he adds the ridiculous claim that attacks on cops are ignored by much of the media or never reported at all. Okay, I think that's debatable. The exact opposite is the truth. In addition, the number of officers killed or wounded by civilians is a stat tracked by nearly every law enforcement agency. Civilians killed or wounded by police officers are stats tracked by amateurs, despite the fact that the Department of Justice has ordered these numbers to be reported annually, an order that has been mostly ignored for the last 13 years. Click on the link there. A whole bunch of links in that, actually. Rabinovich offers these terrible justifications and follows it up with this. If these are the trucks being given away, these are the trucks being implemented into law enforcement service. If someone thinks their tax dollars are better served letting their assets rust away or be given to foreign armies, maybe their cash is greener than yours or mine. Well, yeah, that's a pretty good a point that he brings up, I would say. Because, yes, those are the trucks being given away. However, at the same time, they are giving away Humvees, the H1s, or whatever the hell you want to call them, the Humvees. And other lighter trucks, pickup trucks, and whatnot, too. So why not pick up a Ford F-350 that is beefed up, you know, or a Humvee, which obviously is built beefed up, and use one of those instead, even though it's still a bit of a stretch compared to a squad car, cruiser, or whatever, at the very least. You just look at the armor plating, I guess, and you just look at the beefiness and robustness of a military vehicle without the scare factor of a friggin' MRAP. Seriously? Or the intimidation factor, I would say. If you are against police militarization, then you must be for wasting tax dollars and arming foreigners. Okay. Buzzer, yay. It's that simple. You could not be any less of an American. That's what it's saying there. But at the same time, it's going to foreign, all the stuff that's going to foreign armies supposedly isn't going to enemy armies necessarily. It's going to allied armies or allied military units and whatnot that the U.S. is allied with. Usually, either that or it's scrap. You know, melted down and all that other fun stuff turned into pop cans. Law enforcement agencies don't need mine-resistant vehicles, mainly because of the fact that there's usually no landmines placed where they would be operating anymore. Assault rifles and grenade launchers. Well, the assault rifle thing, I can understand to an extent. Maybe brought down so it's not fully automatic, maybe semi-automatic or whatever, because I know here in Canada, where I did my emergency management training, well, in Ontario anyway, Southern Ontario, the Ontario Provincial Police, I believe it was, they have assault rifles in their cars. I don't know if they all do. Instead of the standard tactical shotgun that they used to carry between the seats, now they have an M4 type weapon, or C7 or whatever it is in Canada. And honestly, I think that's probably a good thing because you got the distance. But then again, I guess you could just use a bolt-action rifle and just learn how to use it. So it'd probably be better. But yeah, and a grenade launcher. You do not need a grenade launcher if you're a friggin' beat cop. Seriously, you do not need that kind of crap. You have your sidearm, you have your long arm, your long gun, I should say. So you got your sidearm, you got your long gun. Blame me. Anyways, law enforcement agencies, blah, 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 do not need that. Law enforcement has existed without all three of these for several decades. I would say several centuries. Or at least a century and a half, 2 centuries. Including years when being a cop was much more dangerous than it is now. Yeah. These justifications are BS. Former Marine Corps Colonel Peter Martino, who was stationed in Fallujah and trained Iraqi soldiers, warned last year, click on the link there, that the Department of Homeland Security is working with law enforcement to build a domestic army because the federal government is afraid of its own citizens, which is, again, another thing that could actually be happening. They are building up their army, which is probably a scary thing because that's happening in Canada too. Not to the same extent here, but we still have, again, M4s in cop cars. Martino was speaking at a council meeting concerning a decision to purchase a Bearcat armored vehicle. I think I read up on that. That's a smaller vehicle, but I could be wrong. I think that's based off a 350 Ford, but I'm not sure. Somebody can look into that, because I'm not checking it now. The purchase of vehicles was mired in controversy after the city's police chief wrote in an application filing to the DHS, Department of Homeland Security, that the vehicle was needed to deal with the threat posed by libertarian sovereign citizen adherents and Occupy activists in the region. Some links there, click on that. So that's actually kind of scary that people are like, oh, we need this because there's these people here. Well, the sovereign citizen movement isn't exactly a bad thing. Actually, it's not a bad thing at all, I don't think. There might be some whack jobs out there, yes. But they want their own... Again, somebody can correct me on this, but they want to be sovereign. They do not want to be led by the U.S. government or Canadian government or whatever government they're in the country of. They want all their stuff to be not controlled by them. Again, that's pretty general, I'd say. Occupy activists, what's going to happen? The worst you're going to have is people camping out there. Maybe a riot or two. Maybe. And honestly, you can kick that crap back with fire hoses. There you go. Pepper spray. Stuff that you have access to. You do not need to have armored vehicles. An armored vehicle, honestly, if you drive now, okay, what's the other people? Libertarians, so people that want to be weather free. Whatever. So, all these people, which don't really pose much of a threat, and to deal with not a big threat. You could have an armored vehicle. Now let's say this. There's a college riot in southern Ontario. I can't remember where the heck it was. It was near Windsor, Ontario, or somewhere. London, Ontario, I think it was. A year or two or 3 years ago. Fanshawe College riots. That's what it is. Fanshawe College. I don't know where the heck that is. Can't remember. It's southern Ontario somewhere. Anyways, the kids rioted. College kids rioted in the streets, two or three streets wide or something like that. And they torched houses. I don't know if they torched houses or not, but they were ripping up fences and throwing shit everywhere. Again, a crap ton of kids. You know, and what did they do? Well, cop cars were swarmed and flipped over and set on fire. What are you going to do with an armored vehicle? It might be a little bit harder to, you know, roll it over and light it on fire. Maybe. But at the same time, you can't run. Why do you think the cop car is stopping it flipped over? It's because you can't run over people. You're not supposed to do that. This is why they stop and they get swarmed and then the cop gets pulled out and then the car gets flipped and torched. Same thing is going to happen with an armored vehicle. Again, it's going to be harder to flip it over and roll it or and torch it, but you know, you can't run through scores of people like a train. You just, it's frowned upon generally. You pretty sure you get your ass with you. That's the end of that story. I'm going off a bit there now. In thought crime news, thank you to Wagga War for this one again. Student arrested for carrying George Orwell's novel 1984. That's actually a very scary premise there. Security services arrested a student in front of the main gate of Cairo University, this is in Egypt obviously, for carrying George Orwell's novel 1984, which we all know and love, obviously, which tackles corruption and dictatorial military regime. Regimes. I keep saying that name wrong, that word wrong today. According to investigations supervised by Major General Mahmoud Farouk, head of Giza investigators, student Mohammed T, who is age 21, who resides in the neighborhood of Warak, was arrested Sunday while in possession of two cell phones without batteries, two USB drives, a hard disk, and a copy of the novel 1984 that speaks about a dictatorial ruling party that criminalizes political rebellion. The security says they also found notes on the student referring to the Islamic Caliphate, which I believe is ISIS, ISIL, whatever the heck you want to call it, and how it should be applied in a country, according to investigations. They pretended, perhaps they even believed, that they had seized power unwillingly and for a limited time, and that just around the corner there lay a paradise where human beings would be free and equal. We know that no one ever seizes power with the intention of relinquishing it. Power is not a means, it is an end. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes a revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. Orwell says in his novel. That's the end of that story, I guess. But, I don't know, that might be a bit of a... maybe a bit of a setup there, maybe. I don't know. What do you guys think about it? Send comments to newsreel2@gmail.com or just go to newsreel.ca and fire off comments there. And our last story for the day in corporate bastard news. Thanks to Log of War for this one once again. From the New York Post. I'm just noticing this New York Post. I don't know. I haven't actually read it or seen it in person, but the New York Post kind of heading, title, bar they have at the top here looks kind of like a tabloid. Anyways, major banks knowingly funded Hezbollah terror operations. Suit. I guess it's a lawsuit. Insert picture of Hezbollah fighters holding party flags in Beirut, Lebanon in November 2012. Mm-hmm. Some of the world's most powerful banks knowingly funded Hezbollah terror operations by concealing billions of dollars in transactions with their Iranian sponsors. A new Brooklyn federal lawsuit charges. Dozens of victims of Hezbollah violence filed suit Monday against Barclays, HSBC, Credit Suisse, Standard Chartered Bank, and Royal Bank of Scotland for purposefully stripping information from the deals allegedly to obscure the involvement of Iranian banks. The suit comes on the heels of a landmark jury. The suit comes on the heels of a landmark jury verdict in Brooklyn Federal Court that found Jordanian banking power Arab Bank guilty of conducting business with Hamas that helped fund terror attacks. The new case was filed by the same attorney who scored that victory, C. Chap Turner of Arkansas. The defendant banks, quote, knowingly and unlawfully agreed to engage in stripping hundreds of millions and in some cases, billions of U.S. dollars on behalf of Iran, knowing that Iran was a designated state sponsor of terrorism, unquote, according to the suit. Eventually landing in Hezbollah's hands, Iranian money aided in planning and perpetrating the murder and maiming of hundreds of Americans in Iraq during the same time the conspiracy was proceeding, according to the suit. Each of the banks named in the suit has already paid massive fines for conducting illicit business with Iran and other sanctioned countries and criminal groups. HSBC paid $1.9 billion, Barclays $298 million, Royal Bank of Scotland $100 million, Credit Suisse $536 million, and Standard Chartered $340 million. Now the relatives of those killed or injured in Hezbollah attacks want compensation for their trauma. According to court papers, the suit refers to more than 60 lethal operations carried out between 2006 and 2011 by Hezbollah and other groups and allegedly financed by Iran. Relatives of those killed and injured in an infamous assault on U.S. military personnel in Karbala, Iraq in 2007 are part of the lengthy list of plaintiffs. That attack left 5 soldiers dead and 3 wounded. So that's very interesting. And that just goes to show you that, banks, again, they're corporate. That's all they are. They're not necessarily, well, I guess they could be government run and government sponsored, depending where you are. But they are essentially, without a doubt, corporations. It's like, oh, well, they're funding this and they're funding that. Well, look at the, well, people you get your drugs from, Bayer. They made Cyclon B or whatever, or something like that for the Nazis. Coca-Cola, which is a big thing right now. It's an American company, even. You know, Germans need to drink Coke too. They were sending all their stuff over there to, they're making money off that. And at the same time, when Coke production wasn't able to continue in Germany during the war years, World War II, where do you think Fanta came from? It was developed in country, in Germany, by Coca-Cola. So we're drinking Nazi drinks here now. But that's what I'm saying. Just as an example, it's a different thing. It's money and blah, 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 but you know what I mean? It's been going on. It always happens. Corporations do not need to answer to anybody. They go to the people who pay the most money or the people who are willing to pay money, whether they are it's their home country or whether it's the opposing country, the invading country. The, you know what I mean? So that's just how corporations work. You know. Anyways, so that's it for the news stories today. We have two items of Cyberprint kit here today. The first one is the, I don't know if it's the Robo-Roach or the Cyborg Cockroach. Thanks to Wagga Wars for this one. It is a YouTube video. I think it's about 13, 14 minutes long. Show us how to turn a cockroach, yes, a live cockroach, into, well, to be able to control it, I guess, with a controller board with a little remote control and stuff. It's pretty cool, I guess. Kind of, at the same time. But that's actually pretty interesting. I never knew you could do that with with a cockroach. But take a look at that. Maybe test it out, see if that works. Pretty cool. And that was a big freaking cockroach. Holy crap. And the next thing we have is was sent in by Gatekeeper called Fire Chat. And this is a Fire Chat, the internet free messaging app that's keeping the Hong Kong protests connected. Now, this is old. Sean sent this back in September, and we just never used it on one of the shows until I saw it today, and it's going in. So I'm gonna read this really quick. Fire Chat sounds like a phony location-based sex line. It is not. It is a messaging app for iOS. Oh, it's only for iOS? That sucks. Well, maybe eventually it'll have come out for Android and all the other systems that we all use, because iOS sucks. We already have WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger, Snapchat, etc. What makes Fire Chat different? You can chat off the grid, even if there's no internet connection or mobile phone coverage. How is that possible? Instead of relying on a central server, it is based on a peer-to-peer mesh network. And connects to nearby phones using Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, with connectivity increasing as more people use it in an area. Insert picture here, blah, blah, blah. Where might this be useful? According to Fire Chat, on the beach or in the subway, at a big game or a trade show, camping in the wild, or at a concert, or even traveling abroad. Simply fire up the app with a friend or two and find out who else is there. There's a video there, which I'm not going to click on. In Hong Kong, seriously though, in Hong Kong mostly, where pro-democracy protesters are using it to communicate amid fears of network shutdowns. It's also been used by Iraqis and Taiwanese students during their anti-Beijing sunflower movement. Aside from not being reliant on the internet, which some governments restrict, it is more clandestine and less traceable. How popular is Fire Chat? Over 100,000 people downloaded it in 24 hours in Hong Kong over the weekend. This is again September. What day was this? September 29th of this year, 2014. On the weekend, with the CEO saying that numbers are booming and up to 33,000 people were using the app at the same time. Will it catch on in the Western world? I'd say it has a better chance than Elo. Yeah, it's quite possible because Elo's kind of iffy right now. But whatever, they're still working on that. That's very cool indeed. Now, that's cool with, well, you don't need a network. It's just, it's ad hoc. It's peer-to-peer, mesh networking, whatever. So that's cool. Now, if you have only two people, three people, that doesn't work like across the country, obviously. You need to be within range of Bluetooth. Bluetooth range is, I think, effective up to 30 feet. That's on a good day, I think, as long as you're not going through walls or anything stupid like that. So Yeah, you can only talk to somebody that's 30 feet away, so that'd be good, I guess, if you're on a train 30 feet away from somebody and you didn't want to sit beside them and talk to them, but you wanted to still talk to them. But I guess what this is for the riots or protests or whatever, blah, 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 if you all have that, you can all talk to each other, especially if you're spread out quite a bit and you still have people every 30 feet or so, or 25 feet or something like that, you know what I mean? A big crowd of people, then yes, you can use it and it'll be better. You could probably get good ranges on it as long as you have people in between you and the other person in range of each other to work. But cool idea, good idea, but also kind of stupid to implement sometimes, don't you? Just go for ham. Hey, there you go. Let's give him a little bow thing, it's a bail thing, or whatever you call it on eBay. Yeah. And so that's all we have for Cyberpunk Kit. And for Recmedia, we have two things. The first one is The Rules, sent in by Kevin as a Geek. I just got this one this morning. Thank you, Kevin. The Rules. This is a big, long list, so obviously I am going to just not read the whole thing. This is on a website called redteams.net. As far as I'm aware, red teams are those people that, in organizations and whatnot, that think outside the box, that think differently and try to come up with different ideas of how things may turn out, i.e. for government, military, corporations, etc. Oh, we're going to do this, blah, blah, blah. This is what our projections are. And let's say, okay, well, if our projections aren't like this, we're going to go and do this, blah, blah, blah. I guess. I don't know. Look it up on Wikipedia. It's hard for me to explain it. The rules. I compiled these rules during many years in the military, in less than permissive environments, and while playing hard in the mountains, maybe as a guide for the long run. Initially, there were 12 rules, the original 12 as I call them. I took concepts and ideas that I learned, simplified them, and created a rule. I also borrowed from other people that passed those rules to me and incorporated them as mine. It all started with a half-joke comment. When in doubt, red team it. Based on the idea behind the Moscow rules, click on the link there. I believe that's a link. Yes, it is. Click on the link there. The original 12 lasted a few years, and I started adding as I became older and more zen. The original 12 rules are as follows. Rule 1, always have an escape plan. That's a good one. Rule 2, be aware of your surroundings. Rule 3, assumption is the mother of all fuck-ups. That is very true. Rule 4, always have a backup plan. Rule 5, never get caught. Rule 6, keep your mouth shut. Rule 7, kiss. Keep it simple, stupid. We all know that one. Rule 8, simple and light equals freedom, agility, and mobility. Rule 9, plan, execute, and vanish. Rule 10, you don't have to like it, you just have to do it. You're given an order, just do it. Rule 11, always invest in good quality stuff. Of course. What does it do? How well does it do it? Rule 12, trust your gut. Very good rules. Now the rules as they are today, starts at rule 0 and goes to rule 89. So that's a bit much. Blah, 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 blah. So there's a few other things here. Don't forget to read Red Team Journal Laws of Red Teaming, and these rules are also organized by functions. So there's two links there. The three plans. 1, always have a plan. 2, always have a backup plan because the first one probably won't work. Yeah. And 3, always have an escape plan because all of the rest of the plans will fail. Remember pace, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. The 5 guiding principles. 1, always have an escape plan. 2, simple and light equals freedom, delay mobility. 3, do not spend time trying to move your opponent, just move yourself. 4, the solution is in the problem. 5, if it's stupid but works, then it isn't stupid. And the explanation behind that, click on that, blah, blah, blah. And then we kick into the new 12 rules. So it's a simplification of the current rules, the 89, the 90 rules that you have. So rule 1, always have an escape plan. Rule 2, never get caught. Rule 3, be aware of your surroundings. Rule 4, always have a backup plan. 5, assumption is the mother of all fuck-ups. 6, trust your gut. 7, simple and light equals freedom, agility, and mobility. Rule 8, kiss. Keep it simple, stupid. Again. Rule 9, the solution is in the problem. Rule 10, don't become predictable. Always a good one. Remember. Rule 11, never take the elevator. Because shit happens in an elevator, and it's hard to fuck upstairs. Also, you get a workout out of it. Boom. Rule 12, always invest in good quality stuff. Again, what does it do? How well does it do it? And there's some other stuff there to continue reading. And apparently this website's got a whole crap load of stuff. And they got a gear page too, so hey. Check it out. Very cool. This is actually redteams.net is the website name. So if you want to check all that stuff out. Ooh, fancy wallet.
You will.
With entry and escape tools. Nice. Okay, so that's there. And the final piece of Rec Media today is a little something that I came up with over the last few years of now, 2014, since 2010, so 4 years in development, called, and now I'm going to take some flack for this one, for all the people that do not like cult, or do not like the idea of it, but anyways, this is called the Cult Revival or Reformation Document. It's currently version 1, and it's still... Whenever I find stuff, I put it in. Anyways, what it is, it's all the information about Cult, the original Virus Manifesto that Sean Kennedy wrote. The new Virus Manifesto 2, which I believe is not even finished. It was written by somebody else, and stuff from the original Cult, stuff from the splinter cells that broke off, or the successor groups, I guess you could say, the different cult.net, cult.info, the cult.whatever, that were run by different people. Cult.org in the original. So yeah, very cool. Just good stuff to have, so if you want to check it out, take a look. Made it available to a few people back in January, February, I think. But yeah, this is going to be for all the WOGs out there. Anybody else who would just like to find the information and check it out and stuff. So I'm not going to... Whatever. Honestly, if there were... See, I'm saying this because the WOG movement is essentially dead. Which is sad to say, but it is. This is why I wanted to do Newsreel. This is why I got my own internet show going on, which is really backlogged, staging area of Maltos Kincaid. And stuff, I wanted to kind of bring back the WOG movement, and this is kind of one of the things that I think might help just to give it a bit of direction, because honestly, there were some good ideas. There were some horrible ideas there too. But yeah. Anyways, whatever. I'm just going to dig myself a hole here right now. Anyways, that's all we have for you today. But don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you get the news that you need to survive. Sorry, choking again. This has been a free WOGcast brought to you by the WOGs Who Care. If you cannot donate to the show, please distribute. But if you can donate, please do so by clicking on the Donate tab on the Rant Media website. Wow, just choking all day here. Thank you to the Army of the Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have information, music, or comments that you'd like to send to us to, of course, use in another episode, then you can reach us at newsreel2@gmail.com, or you can send us the info through our website at newsreel.ca. If you like the music in the background, please be sure to check out Brand Radio Industrial, of course. We'll be fading out now with a track from Assemblage 23 called The Noise Inside My Head. Remember, everyone, we will never defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.